It's a pleasure to have Professor Lisa Willis from the University of Alberta. She's going to tell us about equity, diversity, and inclusion.
Hello, everyone. Everyone can hear me? I can hear me, so you can hear me. Okay, so I'm a scientist. I am a female. I also have a disability. And coming up through sort of science, I do biochemistry. I started my independent lab in February, so I'm a newly minted assistant professor. Coming up through the science ranks, I always had these questions about myself and other women. Why wasn't I seeing female role models? Were things changing? Why are women actually not as good at science as men? These are questions that I and people like me genuinely ask themselves. And at some point, a little while ago, I realized that I had these questions, but I also had the tools to answer them because I'm a scientist and we have literature. And so what I'm going to show you today is what I've discovered and what I've put together in terms of how what the situation looks like, why it looks like that, and what we can do to change it. So the first slide is the most boring slide. And it's just to make sure that we're all on the same page with regards to language. I genuinely hope at the end of this that you will have lots of questions for me and comments and will want to engage with the material. If you're worried that you don't have the right language or you're not sure if that question is politically correct, I don't want you to worry about that. I want this to be your opportunity to actually ask someone who probably has some answers for you or at least can have a discussion with you about these things. So I'm just going to start with equity, diversity, and inclusion. So equity is providing people what they need to succeed. It is not the same as providing everyone with the same thing, okay? If you think about running a race, equality, it's not the same as equality. Equality is providing everyone the same thing. So for running a race, equality would be to give everyone a size 7 shoe. That works great for people with size 7 feet, but not for anyone else. So equity is giving everyone the right size shoe that they need to run their best race. Diversity is just people who are different. Everyone who is different based on ethnicity, cultural identities, LGBTQ, etc. All of this, it all contributes towards diversity. And then inclusion is making sure everyone has the opportunity to participate. You don't necessarily need to make sure that they participate, but that they have the opportunity to do so in a way that is comfortable and safe for them. And then sex and gender. So sex is what you were when you were born. It's your sex organs. It's how your cells respond to hormones, for example. It is mostly binary, male, female, that we all know about, and mostly it doesn't change throughout the course of your life. Gender is who you think you are in the context of society, socially prescribed roles, and all that kind of thing. This is fluid, so it can change throughout your life, and it's not necessarily binary. There's kind of a spectrum. You can be outside the spectrum. There's lots of different ways that you can engage with that. And then lastly, racialization or racialized person. This replaces the outdated terms of visible minority or person of color because it acknowledges that the problem is not you, but that I perceive you to be unequal in ways that matter based on the color of your skin, essentially, or the other physically observable features. So racialization is just the new term, and it actually comes from Ontario. Okay, so your ability to achieve is based on your inherent abilities, which is, you know, your aptitudes for certain things, the things you've been able to engage with, what you like to do, a little bit of luck plays a role, minus the opportunity gap. Okay, so these are things that are sort of outside your control. Socioeconomic background is a big factor. People from poorer socioeconomic backgrounds have less access to the kinds of resources and opportunities that people from high socioeconomic backgrounds have. We don't talk about this a lot, but it is a huge, huge, big deal in what you can achieve. Overt discrimination is when one person, I define, is when one person thinks that they are better than another person because of gender or race or whatever. So this is your classic racism, sexism, all of those other isms. And then we have unconscious bias. This is where you treat someone in a certain way or you think a particular way about someone, but you don't actually know that you're doing it, okay? And the outcome is the same as overt bias. It is still discrimination, but you don't actually know you're doing it. And unconscious biases are behavior that is shaped by implicit or unintended biases. And this comes from society. This comes from us interacting with people, with movies, with music, with all sorts of other media in our groups like this. And ironically, people who value their objectivity, like scientists, like all of us, are paradoxically more likely to fall prey to these biases because they're not paying attention to their behavior. And so what I'm hoping to show you over the course of this lecture is how to pay attention to that bias. Every single person in this room is biased. If you are human, you are biased. We cannot avoid it. The issue is knowing what your biases are, because when you know what your biases are and you're paying attention, you can start to act against those predilections, essentially. So I start with this little example because it's a relatively easy one, and it's one that a lot of people can engage with. When Apple first designed their YouTube app for the iPhone, it was upside down for 5 to 10% of the population. Does anyone know why? Does anyone want to shout out an answer of why that might be? Left-handers, yeah. So this is so funny because when I talk to younger people, they have no idea what I'm talking about because now phones, it doesn't matter which way you turn it upside down or right side up, the phone just goes automatically. But back in the day, left-handed people, it was upside down. That's because they didn't have enough left-handers on their design team for it to make a difference, right? And so it's just a cute little example. But if you are not paying attention to this, it can have, you know, substantially negative consequences. This just cost them a little bit of money. But 8 out of 10 drugs that were withdrawn from the US market around the turn of the century posed greater health risks to women than men. And in 2 cases, those drugs were actually fatal in women and not men. And they were never tested in women because the clinical trial test group is males between the ages of 18 and 45. So they were never tested in women, and they ended up killing people. So this is important, and it is important for you and for your science. So the talk is divided into 4 main parts. I'm going to show you data. I'm going to show you a lot of data. I'm going to overwhelm you with data. I'm going to show you data about why actually incorporating diversity into your research groups is going to improve your productivity based on science. I'm going to show you what the numbers are for Canadian STEM and how they've been changing, what the evidence of discrimination is and how it shows up on a daily basis, and then lastly, how we fix this and incorporate that into how we write grant EDI applications. Okay, so companies perform better with increased diversity. This is just one example. McKinsey is one of the largest world management consulting groups. The data is 4 years old now. But what they did was to assess the financial performance of companies based on the composition of their board. And so they ranked the companies from the ones with the most females on the board to the one with the least female on the board, and compared the top quartile to the bottom quartile. And the top quartile, I'm not even gonna use that, top quartile outperforms financially the bottom quartile. And they did the same thing with ethnic diversity. The top quartile substantially outperforms the bottom quartile when it comes to ethnic diversity on their boards. And we know that diverse teams focus more on facts, they process those facts more carefully, and they are more innovative. We know this, there's lots of data to prove this. I'm just gonna show you 3 studies actually. I've tried as much as I can to talk about both gender as well as ethnicity, where I could find studies, good studies that I thought were well done that would support that. So to start with gender diversity, this is a study. I've also chosen studies where the take-home message can be illustrated with one graph so that I'm not boring you going through papers. So in this study, they looked at gender diversity and the ability of small teams to complete tasks. So they had 700 people, put them into small groups, and asked them to complete a series of 7 tasks, video game, architecture design, that kind of thing. And they wanted to know what was it that actually helped that team finish the task the fastest and the best. And it was not the average member intelligence. It was not even the maximum member intelligence. It was a combination of factors. And what went into this combination of factors was social perceptiveness, parity and conversational turn-taking, and the proportion of females in the group. And we know that females contribute to social perceptiveness, are better socially perceptive, and encourage and contribute to parity and conversational turn-taking. So that's gender. Ethnicity, this one is about ethnicity. The last one was a controlled study. This is just a correlational study. They looked at the 2.5 million research papers published between 85 and 2008 in PubMed. All of the authors are in the US, okay? 11 scientific fields, authors, they assigned ethnicity to each of the surnames and found that authors with English surnames were more likely to publish where that paper had all authors with English surnames, more likely than you would expect based on the total number of English surnames in their database. And the same is true for Russian, Korean, and Chinese. So we like to work with people who look like us and think like us and talk like us. It's comfortable. It's just not necessarily as productive. So papers with 4 or 5 authors of different ethnicities had 5 to 10% more citations. Now you can say that, you know, big institutions like, UCLA and Scripps and Harvard attract people from different cultures. So they have people with different ethnicities. They also have more money, so they publish more. So here is a controlled study that's not in science, it's in economics, but it illustrates how diversity is important for team science. So what they did in this study was to have a small group of people in a room trading stocks. And the idea is that you want to figure out how accurate they are at assessing the price of that stock. If you start trading stocks at a higher price than they're actually worth, you end up with a price bubble, and price bubbles are bad when they burst. So what they did, they started with North America, and they had a homogeneous market. So this is 6 people that are all white. And you can see that in North America, we're not actually very good at accurately pricing stocks. It's very low. But then as soon as you add in Black and Hispanic people into this group, you see that the pricing accuracy goes up. And that's not because the Black or Hispanic people in the study had higher financial acumen. They tested financial acumen at the beginning, and they were all the same across the individuals in the groups. Okay, so the diverse team did better than the homogeneous team. They wanted to show that this is not a white North American phenomenon, so they did the same thing in Southeast Asia. So the homogeneous market is all Chinese people, and Chinese people obviously have a higher starting financial acumen than the North Americans do. We can talk about why that is later. Nevertheless, as soon as you added in Malaysian and Indian individuals into the group, their pricing accuracy went up. Okay, so these are just 2 examples. There are lots in the literature that demonstrate that the more diverse your team is, the more productive it is. The more voices that you can bring to the table, the more they challenge your thoughts. We are more likely to blindly follow a leader who looks like us than to challenge their ideas. Okay, so what are the numbers in Canada? These are standardized elementary school and high school tests. For math, there's no statistical difference between men and women, boys and girls in this case. If you look at grade 12 provincial exams, there are 25,000 more women taking biology 12 provincial exams than men. There are also more taking chemistry exams. Math is about the same, and physics is the one discipline where we start to see issues even at the high school level. The attrition rate for women is higher than for men at every post-secondary level. So 52% of people graduating with high school diplomas are women. Only 41% of people in all STEM in Canada graduating with bachelor's degree are women, 37% master's, and then 32% doctoral. And one of the interesting, shocking things that I found when I first did this research, this incidentally comes from NSERC. It's NSERC's report that was released in 2017. The thing that I found the most shocking is that these numbers haven't actually changed in 20 years. Okay, so we might feel like things are getting better, but the numbers in Canadian STEM don't support that. If you break it down by field, this is just showing that it hasn't changed. This is the height of the bar is the number of degrees granted, and the number on top is the percentage of women. So life and physical sciences, physics would be in here. You see this same attrition, there's higher attrition at every level. Some of you might be in the more math, computer science thing. You don't see necessarily that same level of attrition, but it's still much lower. And then what are they doing after their degree? They are not, women are not staying in science. So if you look at that first 10 years after a bachelor's degree, there are more men in the natural sciences and engineering and in management, and then women just leave. Women are less likely to be hired as professors. So over here, this is the physical sciences. The purple bar is assistant professors, so 27.6% of assistant professors are female, even though 40% of PhD holders in the life and physical sciences are female, 20% of associate professors, and then 9.2% of full professors. The gray bar are non-tenured faculty. They're like QB, sessional lecturers, that kind of thing. I looked up the numbers for the Perimeter Institute just based on what I could tell from your website, and you are... You're not that far off of the Department of Physics at the University of Alberta. But with numbers like this, it means that small changes can have big effects. So you can look at the silver lining there. Women are less likely to publish. This is a fantastic website. It's completely interactive. What they did was to take all papers, again in PubMed. I wish that Archive or BioArchive had this kind of data. To mine, but this is PubMed, all papers between 2002 and 2016, and they assessed whether the authors were male or female. And so you can break it down by field, by journal, by last author, total author, first author, by country. So this data shows all countries, all authors, and each of these is a different field. So 50-50 male-females here, this is 75% women and 75% men. And you can pick, these are different fields, and the size of the bubble is the size of the papers published in that field. And I've just chosen a couple that I thought would be relevant to this audience. You can see that biophysics and nanotechnology are pretty low. So they are increasing. They're increasing in every field that is south of parity, but they're not increasing very fast. And in fact, we won't reach parity at our current rate in my lifetime. Now, this data also are not corrected for the total number of female researchers in that area. That's an important consideration to make. But the point that I want to make here is that this is all authors, all countries. This data is all authors for Canada, right? All countries, Canada. We are not leading the charge here. And I think that's terrible. Okay, so that was a lot about women. What can I tell you about racialized students and faculty? They are underrepresented, but I can't actually tell you how they are underrepresented because we don't collect that data in Canada. So I think U of T, or not U of T, Ryerson and York, I think, are now starting to collect that data. So I can't tell you much about their numbers. What I can show you is this data from the States, which I think is important. So this study was to look at the percentage of students who start their undergrad wanting to major in one of the natural sciences and engineering, but don't actually do it. So we want this number to be as small as possible because we want everyone who wants to be able to. So only 1.5% of white students who want to don't. 7% of Asian, 20% Latino, and 40% Black. And I think our indigenous students are even lower on this. So we are not supporting our students the way they need it. And then this book comes from UBC. It looks at Canadian universities. 5 to 17% of faculty at Canadian universities are racialized, despite the fact that 22% of Canadians self-identify as visible minorities. And 5 is at smaller places like Memorial, and 17 is at larger places like U of T. Okay, so what are the barriers? I've painted a bleak picture. Why is it like this? This was a study, The Hidden Brain Drain. It's commissioned by Microsoft, Johnson & Johnson, a whole bunch of really big companies, because they wanted to understand this phenomenon. So they had lots of junior employees, and the women all wanted to quit. Lots of junior female employees, and the women all wanted to quit, essentially. And so they asked why. What was going on in their institutions, in their environments, that was causing this issue? And these were the top 4 answers. So hostile macho cultures, these are jokes, these are assumptions about what is women's work. These are being fired because you are, or feeling like you're going to be fired because you want to start a family, that kind of thing. Isolation is where you are the only one who looks like you in a room. And so that feels very isolating. You don't have anyone to talk to who might have some similar experiences as you. Scarcity of effective sponsors. So a mentor is someone who provides psychosocial support, and a sponsor is someone who will call up someone they know at a company and say, I've got this great postdoc. They would make an excellent person at your company. You should hire them. Someone who will actually use their power to help you, help your career. And women have problem with effective sponsors. And then lastly is difficulty with executive presence. So we are very, very good at having women work under us. We are less okay with having women with the same power as we do, and we're really not okay with working for women. You're gonna see in a second that this is men and women have a problem with this. So this is what executive presence is. The higher up you go, the more problems people have with you as a woman. So I talk about this example that I talked about this morning with a couple of people. That was a little study where people were asked to read a scenario and respond. And the scenario was, there was civil unrest downtown, and the police chief sent officers to deal with it, but didn't send enough officers. People were hurt and had to go to the hospital. And so the people reading the scenario were asked whether or not that police chief should be fired for not taking the appropriate action. And if the police chief's name was male, only 10% of people felt that person should be fired. And if the police chief's name was female, 30% of people felt that person should be fired. So there's a higher penalty for doing things wrong when you're a woman, especially higher up. And this translates into our daily lives. If you're a woman speaking up, there's a higher penalty. You don't necessarily want to speak up as much. And so when you look around in your meetings, you have to ask yourself if your women feel like it's okay for them to participate. Come back to that in a second. Okay, so this is my all-time favorite study, the Jennifer John study. Some of you already know about this, so I'll just go through it quickly. 130 profs were sent the resume of a student who had just finished undergrad, wanted to go to grad school, but was applying to become a research manager, and asked the faculty to rank whether this student was competent on a scale from 1 to 7, whether they were hireable, and if they were hireable, what their starting salary would be, and whether the student was deserving of mentoring. And the only difference in the CVs was that half were given the name Jennifer and half were given the name John. And Jennifer was less competent, she was less hireable, and in fact, her starting salary was about $4,000 less than his, and she was also less worthy of mentoring. The take-home message that I want you to get from this is that faculty members' bias was independent of their gender. Okay? Women are just as biased as men against women, because this is a cultural thing. We all think that white men are better than everyone else, because this is what our society tells us, and we perpetuate this every day with our actions. Okay? This is really important. This is just one study. I have lots that show the same thing. So independent of their gender, scientific discipline, age, and tenure status, The younger generation is not going to save us on this. So that's female. I don't have a really good study in STEM for racial bias, but I do have this study. If you've got a typically black name, like Aisha, you have to send out 50% more CVs in order to get the same number of callbacks as someone with a white name, like Greg or Emily. Okay, so this is a small study. It was only 130 professors. Don't worry about how much text is on the slide. We're going to go through it. This was a giant study. More than 6,000 professors at American universities were sent an email from a student who had just finished their undergrad and wanted to do grad school with the professor and was asking the professor if that person had 10 minutes to talk about this possibility. And the only difference in the emails was that the names were either obviously male or female, and then they were either they were obviously white, black, Hispanic, or Chinese. And white men were responded to with higher frequency than any other group. Okay? So this is what is meant by white male privilege. Okay? It's not that being a white male is easy. It's not that life is easy. It's not you get whatever job you want. It's not that you go to a grant you want. But it is this slight advantage that people actually respond to your emails. You can have a lesser application that's given the benefit of the doubt more than a woman's. And it's even worse if you are a woman of color. Okay, this sort of compounds the issue. And again, in this study, faculty members' bias was independent of whether the faculty member was male or female. Okay, this is a really cool study. They weren't interested necessarily in looking at the differences between women or men. What they wanted to do was to figure out if there was a mathematical formula that could predict whether or not when a person would get a faculty position, would become an assistant professor based solely on their CV. And they can. They came up with a model that, you know, has number of citations, number of articles, number of first author articles, the institution that they came from, all of that kind of thing. They can predict the length of time it takes for you to start in your scientific career as judged by your first publication to when you become an assistant professor, which is judged by your first last author publication. So it's not perfect, but you can actually figure that out, predict it. Unless you're a woman. Women with identical CVs do not get hired as fast. A woman to get hired in the same length of time has to have a better CV than a man. In two-person conversations, men are more likely to interrupt women. In two-person teams, men are considered to be the more influential. Men collaborate with men. Women are invited to speak less. This one is a really cool one. Women are perceived as less competent than men as instructors. This is another one of those simulated studies where undergraduate students were actually given a transcript of a lecture and asked to evaluate the effectiveness of that professor. And if the professor's name was female, she was less competent than if the professor's name was male, based on the exact same criteria. So this is really important when you use student evaluation of faculty teachers in promotion and tenure decisions. And then doctors with foreign accents are perceived as less competent. That was actually done in Alberta, which is where I am now. So I like to break this down into four big areas. So you can't fix the problem if you can't identify the problem, okay? And I think what I've shown you is that this problem exists at every level, and it snowballs, right? If you're not given the opportunity to publish, then you're not invited for awards, you're not invited for talks. If you're not invited for talks, you're not necessarily given awards. It snowballs throughout your career. And so we need to be able to identify what this looks like on a daily basis in order to be able to address it. Because it's multiple problems, there is no one solution. The solution is actually a million tiny things that every single one of us does. So we have the disrespect. So this is where men interrupt women. First name, last name. So men are more likely to be called by their last name. I actually got this when I started my new faculty position. I got an email from a company representative wanting to sell me something. It said, "Hi, Lisa. Dr. Wakarchuk told me that you got this new position. I also know your PhD supervisor, Dr. Whitfield, and the longtime research associate in the lab, Dr. Clark." Yeah, no need to tell you that Drs. Wakarchuk, Whitfield, and Clark are all men. and Lisa is the only female. Languages, jokes, music, particularly misogynistic music playing in the lab, leaving out women out of group emails, expectation stereotypes. So are you expecting the women to be doing, who are the same level as the other people in your lab? Are you expecting them to do more of the managerial work, more of the ordering, more of the organizing, that kind of thing? Being inclusive in social activities, are you scheduling meetings for 7 a.m. when you have people who are parents in your lab? That's unacceptable. Lack of acknowledgement, so women not getting credit for ideas. I can't tell you the number of times I've been in a meeting where a woman has said something, come up with an idea, and it was sort of dismissed, and not 5 minutes later, a man came up with the same idea, and he was given the credit for it. Everyone was like, oh yeah, it's a great idea. It happens. It happens in every single environment that I've been in. This is a real thing. And two-person teams. Reference letters. So people tend to use gendered language in reference letters. So men are referred to as superstars, they're excellent, blah, blah, blah. And women are referred to as good team players, and that kind of thing. Lack of opportunities. So we've talked about these speaker initiatives, collaborations, funding, all of that kind of thing. Insider information. This one is it's really interesting. So when you're friends with people, you're socializing with them more, you find out about opportunities more quickly, or you have the opportunities to collaborate. This is something that happens in our groups. We tend to, I don't know what it's like in physics, but chemists and biochemists, we drink a lot, we go out to the bar, and that's where a lot of our collaborations happen. But if you're not in that in circle, if you're not someone who was invited out to the bar, you're now no longer have the opportunity to participate in that scientific idea, whether it's, you know, writing a review article or whatever it is. So when this comes to your labs, if you're a PI, you can pay attention to this. You know, if your student comes to you and says, we're going to write a review article, you can say, okay, great, but so-and-so also has this expertise. I think you should include her in the process. So this is the things that you can do. And then the double standard. So this is the higher penalty for speaking up in groups, for taking risks, for negotiating. It's harder to do those things when you are penalized for them. And so as supervisors, and even as, you know, not necessarily supervisors, you can create an environment where people know that it is okay to speak up. Just by saying, I value your input. I think that's wrong, or for, you know, for whatever reason, but thank you for offering that. I really value your input. Cold calls for hiring. So women are less likely to make a cold call to someone that they've never talked to, or to apply for a job for which they don't meet every criteria that is listed in the job ad. So there are things that you can do here. So for example, specifically invite people from diverse groups to apply, not at the bottom with that standard text, women and everyone else are invited to apply, they're valued, yeah, yeah. Put that up where people actually know that you mean it. And then don't have a list of every criteria the person needs to have. The person needs to be creative. They need to be a problem solver. And then it would be nice, you know, so these are the need to have, and then it would be nice if you had one or more of the following, and that's where you list your specific scientific discipline. For family, men who are fathers are viewed highly. That's a plus if you're a father. Women who are mothers are viewed negatively. So there's the double standard here. The double standard in supervisor feedback, and then executive presence, as we talked about. So this, it's a huge thing. It happens every day, every minute of every day. And the problem is that small bias can have a big effect. So this is a simulation that was done a long time ago, it doesn't matter. 500 people start in the bottom, and you lose, I think, 15% at every level that you go up the hierarchy till you get to only 10 people at the top. And you start off 50% female, 50% male, but it doesn't matter, it could be any two groups. And you move up or down the ladder based on a randomly generated performance score. The only difference is that women, for women, that randomly generated score is between 1 and 100. And for men, that randomly generated score is between 1 and 101. It's only a 1% difference. But over 20 simulations, you can see what happens at the top. Okay? So small bias has big effect. So what do we do? Step one is to hold yourself accountable. You are human, you have biases. Figure out what they are. You can take the Harvard Implicit Bias Test online. It's a fun little thing to take. But just start thinking about it. It's easy. I know what my biases are. And when you think about it, when you acknowledge that you have them, you can pay attention in your daily interactions. You're interacting with someone, you're having a response to them, you're, you know, maybe don't think that they're a valued member of your team or that they would be a valued member of your team. Just stop and think, is any of that decision, is any of that gut feeling due to the fact that they don't look like me? And then along the same lines, challenge your assumptions and justify your decisions. Exact same thing. Be inclusive in your environment when you are organizing something. Pay attention to whether or not someone has kids and can show up at a 7 p.m. for a 7 p.m. meeting. Maybe you shouldn't be having 7 p.m. I can tell you, you shouldn't be having 7 p.m. meetings. Pay attention to food allergies. Pay attention to whether or not someone is afraid of heights. If you've got someone afraid of heights in your lab, don't take everyone to Wonderland. Like, it's common sense. You don't need to know the issues of everyone in your lab. What you do need to do is say, I'm organizing this event. Here is what I would like to do. Please tell me what I can do, how I can modify this to include you. Step two is to hold others accountable. Okay, so this is a cultural thing. Every one of us is participating in this, and so we can start to hold every one of us accountable. Create a culture of calling out unconscious bias. People find this really uncomfortable. But it doesn't have to be. You don't, in my experience, calling someone out as racist or sexist is unproductive. It's not that it's not true. It's not that this unconscious bias doesn't result in the same discrimination. But racists are bad. We all know that racists are bad people. I'm not a bad person, therefore I can't be racist. And that's some of the things that go on. So what I like to do is say, do you know those jokes aren't appropriate anymore? Or, I really wish you wouldn't say things like that. It makes me think less of you. Things like that are ways that you can call out unconscious bias without making a confrontation out of it. Make others justify their decisions and make decisions collectively. Data shows that when you do that, you do better at reducing bias. Having these conversations on a daily, monthly, weekly basis, daily, weekly, monthly basis is so important. So for example, in your groups, maybe once per month, instead of in lab meeting talking about some of the literature on your field, talk about some of the literature that's coming out in the EDI field. And then you can have this conversation. It is so important to constantly be paying attention, constantly be vigilant when it comes to these kinds of things. And then take action. So one of the things that I did was to educate myself so that I could have these conversations, especially with scientists who like to push and try to break down the science that I've showed. I can effectively argue, have a discussion, not argue, but have a discussion to actually get at some of the issues and to come up with some of the solutions. Be a mentor and be an ally. So be an ally. If there's a woman who is just interrupted in your meeting, say, okay, hold on, I want to hear what she has to say. Can you let her finish our conversation? Again, it's not confrontational, but it does bring light to the issue and it addresses it. Listen. So people from underrepresented groups feel alone. They feel like they can't bring their full selves to work. And essentially what it comes down to is that we're losing out on human capital. Right? Human capital is what our labs run on. We need everyone's ideas. We need everyone to be able to bring their best selves to work because that is when we are going to be the most productive. That is when the breakthroughs that you guys all really, really want are going to happen. Okay? It's when everyone can participate. So listen to people's stories. Listen to what it is that they're experiencing. You do not necessarily have to solve the problem. Okay, as scientists, we feel like we need to solve the problem. You don't have to solve the problem. You just need to listen and say, I hear you, you're heard, that sucks. How can I help you? Advocate for others. and use good hiring practices. So there are lots of things that we can do. We talked about some of them earlier today. For example, I have a code of conduct that's on my website. I didn't write it, my students wrote it. And then we workshopped it together, and it was another one of these opportunities to have a discussion about EDI. We actually have discussions about professionalism because frequently our students don't know what a professional behavior looks like. And a lot of this stuff is just unprofessional. Students, undergraduate students have never had a job. They've maybe never lived away from home in some cases. So they don't know what is okay and not okay. Most of their friends are also their colleagues. And so this whole separation from professional and private lives, they don't know what that means. So having a conversation about professionalism is a way you can segue yourself into this general area. So code of conduct, advertising that this is important to you, making it important to you, and then advertising that it's important to you. There was a great study that was done at the University of Montana where hiring for a year was separated into the regular anti-discrimination group and the intervention group. And in the intervention group, there were only three things that happened. One is that that committee got half an hour training on unconscious bias. Two was that they were given language for how to make their job ad appeal to a diverse group of people. And then three was the candidate that came to interview was given half an hour with a work-life balance person, someone who could talk about schools in the area, someone who could talk about your family room, who wasn't on the committee. So those were the only three things. And hiring of women increased sixfold in the intervention group versus the control group. And so subsequently, all hiring at Montana State University had the intervention group, and hiring has been 50% women ever since. So that's another good hiring practices, and I've got lots. I've got lots of solutions for individual problems. I'm happy to talk about them. And then lastly, how do you actually write about this? So this is NSERC's new merit guidelines for this competition. And I think that they serve as a really good template for all EDI statements, for CRC chairs and for other things. And I'm sure most of you know that the Dimensions program has started in Canada. So this is becoming really important. As per the federal government, they have indicated that they are willing to start withholding funding from institutions that do not demonstrate a commitment to EDI. So this is going to be really important for your institution going forward, especially given how skewed your faculty are. So just looking at the merit grant indicators at the exceptional, you need to identify the challenges related to EDI in your institution and in your field. And I think your institution, because it's just physics, is also very representative of your field. And there's certainly some issues there. And then you need to identify how you are hiring, how you're supporting the hiring of diverse HQP. And I've given you a couple of ideas, but I'm happy to talk about more. And how you are making your environment inclusive. And so what you need to do in these statements is to talk about the things that you personally are doing to improve things. It doesn't matter if your lab is 50% female. If it's 50% female, you still need to be supporting those women in a way that they're going to be successful in their other, in their future careers, whatever those careers are. And it also doesn't matter if your lab has no women in it. You need to talk about what you are doing, A, to hire more diverse HQP, and then B, how are you going to support them? And you can use all of the ideas that I've just talked about on that previous slide. Okay. Questions?
Okay, traditionally we start from the students in the audience.
Hi.
Hi. Okay.
So when I talk about this topic with colleagues or friends, I get the response, one, how significant are the studies you're showing me? Or two, are you only showing me studies that support your idea? So what would you respond
to? So there are lots and lots of studies, and I have definitely cherry-picked ones, not necessarily that demonstrate the biggest bias, but that I felt were done well and that captured that picture in a single image so that I could talk about it. But if you actually look at the bulk of the literature, it's overwhelming. It's very clear that this occurs. There are some studies, for example, that demonstrate that women are less prone to take risks than men. But again, subsequent studies have shown that, yes, in that study that was the case. But that study is examining a specific scenario where the risk for women taking risks is higher. The penalty for doing that is higher. And so if you take women and men and you put them into a situation for which neither is trained, like jumping out of an airplane, for example, the risk-taking interest in men and women is the same. So yes, I've cherry-picked studies, but the body of evidence is overwhelmingly clear that this exists and that it exists at every level.
Io sono Pastor Generoli.
I usually have better hands than that. So two questions. The first one is, do biases change and develop over time?
Yes.
Okay. And secondly, and I kind of thought that was the answer.
Are you talking about personal biases?
Yeah, personal biases. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. So then my second question, I thought that was the answer. My second question would be, if that's the case, is the structure of the university system wrong then? I.e., I'm going to throw this out there, tenuring. Because if your biases change over time and you're tenured, why would you change anything? Because there's no mechanism, if you will, or levers to change the person's attitude. Or buy it.
You know, if the voting population is any indication, that I think you just get more biased with time and not less. So when I say your biases change, I don't think you're losing some. As to whether or not the university structure needs to change, yes, there are so many problems with the university structure. You guys have an opportunity here. You know, I've talked to a lot of people throughout the day, and you are not necessarily beholden to that university structure. So there is a lot of opportunity there to be a little bit different and to be inclusive in exciting and interesting in different ways. You can try things that maybe a university can't because its administration is so incredibly bureaucratic. So yes. Does that answer your question? We have a question down here.
I'm not gonna.
Yeah, thank you for a wonderful talk. I want to step back a little bit from universities and, let's say, scientific careers and all that, and ask, given that this problem is so large and the evidence is so strong, why isn't it that, for example, organizations like the United Nations are not have an international panel on bias and exclusion in science? Because, you know, obviously the planet faces enormous challenges, whether it's global warming or destruction of the environment, extinction of species. And we know that science is key to solving those problems. But if we exclude from science the people who are most impacted by those destructive phenomena, how is science going to play a useful role? Because, I mean, you know, what struck me looking at your measures, which are generally about how people are prevented from pursuing effective careers in science, that for me is a less important objective than actually taking care of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're excluding those people, there's really something that needs to be, I mean, just like there's the IPCC,
yep.
And there's now a very exciting new initiative on preventing extinctions,
mm-hmm.
again, coming from the UN. There has to be something about combating the exclusion.
Yeah, so I think there are, like, there's certainly not an international committee, but the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation really acknowledges this problem and is trying to combat it. I think this is very, very much it's certainly worse in North America and in Western Europe. So it's not necessarily a global problem because we don't have it. So in Africa, for example, and in Eastern Europe, there are more female scientists than male for many reasons. So I'm not sure that it's necessarily a global problem in the way that global warming is a global problem. But there are people putting money towards it, for sure. And I think that it's important that I completely agree with you, that we should be thinking about the health of the planet, and that if we all did a little bit better, then we might be able to actually solve some of these big problems faster. Yeah.
I mean, the opportunities for scientists in Africa are way smaller than they are in North America, than in Western Europe. So that is a global problem.
That they have fewer scientific opportunities?
Yeah.
Yes, I would agree.
On any measure.
Yes, but the disparity between women and men in Africa is not as bad. In fact, there are more female than male scientists.
So they're all starving. Doesn't make it
right, right.
Right.
So what you're saying is that we should be funding more science in Africa and globally?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I don't disagree.
Changing topics a little bit. I think in the current career, scientific career model for most of the scientists might tell me differently, there is this model that you go to one school for college, a different school, graduate school, somewhere else for a postdoc, somewhere else for and that, of course, it's not conducive to having a stable family, which affects more women than men. Are there any alternative models? Is there talk about these being determinant, for example, in the attrition rates that are observed?
Yeah, so that's definitely a piece of the puzzle. I think it's 80 or 90% of female academics have a spouse that is also in a professional career, but it's only 50% of male academics. So that's a big deal. The question of when you have children and the support that you have when you're having children. But these are things that we can address by having a family room, by having support. So for example, the institution funding a temporary lab technician for the length of time that a woman is on mat leave. There are lots of things that we can do to support a woman through that transition. Most academic women that I know are incredibly ambitious. Yes, they want children, but they also really, really love their careers. And it is not their intention to just disappear for a year and then come back. Most of them are still reading papers. They're still writing while they're on mat leave. They're just not necessarily coming in to the office from 9 to 5 every day, because that's a little bit more difficult. So I think we need to rethink how we think about parents and how we think about family, and we need to value that. Because again, when you're a parent, there's a little bit of data to suggest that you're actually more productive and more creative, and you're better able to organize your time. Maybe not in that first year or two. But also you're another one of these different viewpoints that might be able to bring something new to the table. So we want to encourage people, I think, to be parents. We just need to make it possible for them to do so.
Yeah, I was actually wondering whether this structure that we have for the
of moving
for the moving is because it was easier for men to be followed by their families.
It definitely contributes to some women leaving. It definitely does. Yeah.
So I was wondering, when you mentioned that Canada was not the leading area or leading body in diversity inclusion, you mentioning like Western Europe or Africa and that kind of thing, like, yes, there are more women in the field, but I was wondering, is it also culturally something that's playing a big part in making like us more able to join or something like that? Like, I mean, obviously you're offering a lot of solutions,
mm-hmm.
but I'm wondering, are they using these specific solutions or are they catered to North America?
These solutions are for our problems. Their mm-hmm. problems mm-hmm. are different and they don't have some of the same problems. When I say that Canada is not leading, the UK and Australia have been doing an amazing job. Our Dimensions program is based on their programs. For the last 10 years, they've been doing a really good job. Biotech is also far more advanced than we are at academic institutions because they recognize, the data is clear, they recognize that women are integral. Diversity is integral for financial, for productivity of the company. So they are also much more ahead of us, but they don't necessarily publish as much. So when we're talking about publishing, we're talking about predominantly North American institutions and European and now more and more and more Asia as well. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. So you talked a bit about bias on maternity leaves and women going on leave. What about men going on paternity leave? How does that bias, is it favorable for men to leave to go on paternity leaves in countries that do have it and organizations that provide it? And do men take it? And can you expand a bit on that? Because I know that there's probably some studies on that.
Yeah, so I mean, from an academic point of view, your career is always slightly less productive when you have a new kid. But dads being very involved in their children's lives, especially when they're infants, is incredibly beneficial to the child, especially if that child is female. There's evidence that suggests that interaction in the first, particularly 2 to 5 years of life, if that dad-daughter bond, when there's more of that, the daughter is more likely to have fewer gender stereotypes and is more likely to go into STEM fields. So it's definitely better for the family unit, which I think is better for our society. And honestly, I don't think that you know, losing a cumulative 3 to 5 months is really going to harm your career in the long run. But that's a personal decision that everyone has to make. Certainly, there are more men taking parental leave now than there have ever been before, but the numbers are still substantially lower than for women. Oh, is there a social bias? Yeah. I mean, depending on your institution, there's absolutely a bias against men taking parental leave. At my institution, I heard someone tell someone else that you weren't a serious scientist if you had kids, which is... I doubt that the person saying it could actually find a significant other who would want to live with them long enough to have children. Nevertheless, though, for the person who had children, that was one of these things, you don't belong, you're not good enough, you don't belong here. And so that had a really negative effect on the person who heard that. So yes, these exist, and we need to change them, because that's ridiculous.
Hi. I was curious about some of the measurements used in the studies you mentioned. So for intelligence.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
What was the IQ?
I can't remember, actually. I think what happened was they were all given It wasn't an IQ test. It was that they were all given the same task and asked to repeat it. And that was, if I recall correctly, in that study, that was a proxy for their intelligence.
Yeah. And the other question was about using number of papers published as a measure of success. Is that common in these kinds of studies?
That was certainly how the study that looked at predicting when you would get hired. I mean, that's what that study was all about, trying to figure out if there was a minimum number of papers or something like that.
Okay, I was just wondering, could there be other ways of measuring success?
And absolutely.
Other studies that use those?
Yeah, and so it partially depends on the field. So, in math, for example, they don't publish as many papers per year as they do in biology. In computer science, giving talks at prestigious conferences are the measure of success. So every field has its different ways of measuring success. But I think in general, we should be looking at redefining what we think excellence is. Because this notion of one lone rock star it's not realistic. No one does science in a vacuum. But it's also not productive. And it's not healthy, and it tends to lead to bad behaviors on part of the scientist and everyone else. We tend to idolize scientists in all fields. We really idolize scientists, individuals, and that's a bad thing, I think. There's an interesting article that I didn't totally agree with, but it had some interesting points called The Fetishization of Excellence in Academia. And it was about what we define excellence as. And I think it's highly worth a read, just as a think piece, and then to have a conversation in your labs or at your departmental meeting about what is actually important. And what will get you those breakthroughs that you so desperately want.
At the back. Thank you for the talk, Dr. Willis. I had two questions regarding inclusivity. So the first is, I understand that there are axes we are talking about, like ethnicity and gender, but like there's an axis I haven't heard about, which is neurodiversity. Many people are on the spectrum. Mm. And like how to include those people mm-hmm. in the dialogue is a whole other nuance that I would like to hear about. Mm-hmm. And the second question is not so much a question, but like a request for reframing. So the way I understood, one of the results that one of the papers that you suggested shared was about homogeneity versus diversity and how having a more diverse group made the results better. Mm-hmm. And to me, the message I'm getting out of this is we should have diversity because it makes things better. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a problematic statement.
Mm-hmm.
Because in inclusivity, I just want to hear something like, if there are people in a room, you want to respect them for the sake of respecting them, not because it makes something better.
Yeah, no, so you make a really good point. And I'm going to address that one first. You're absolutely right. Just bringing these people into the room is entirely insufficient. You have to support them. You have to acknowledge that they work differently, that they think differently, and that they have different needs. And that is inclusion. Making sure that, and equity is making sure that they have what they need to succeed. So for example, hiring a token woman just to change the percentage of those numbers is wildly inappropriate. Pushing more women into the pipeline just to get to a situation where they are degraded and disrespected and devalued is morally reprehensible. You absolutely have to be inclusive and practice inclusive behavior in your environments. Absolutely, 100% agree. The other one was is essentially, I'm gonna put it under disability, even though I'm not 100% sure if it qualifies what exactly you're talking about, but that's where I'm gonna put it. because it's just, or maybe not disability, but it's a different kind of diversity. It's a different way of thinking about things. It might be a little slower than the quick, you know, ways that sometimes we interact with one another, but it comes back to the same point as your second question about being inclusive. So this is not about making sure that the numbers are 50-50 women, men. It's not about making sure that there are a variety of colors in the audience for the sake of the variety of colors. It's about enriching the science. And people with disabilities and people who think differently and people who respond differently are just as valued, need to be valued, because they have just as much to contribute. And so that comes back to this idea of human capital and making sure that you are getting as much out of people as they can, giving them the opportunity to be the best that they can. So I think that comes under the same umbrella as inclusion and paying attention to that kind of diversity.
I just want to build on that comment. Specifically, I was curious about the concept of EDI washing, because I think that that's a real risk in institutions and systems trying to make this change, is that they will tend toward the diversity. So I want to go back to that NSERC slide where you had a rubric and just talk about the kinds of accountability structures that really drive intent to change. Because being intentional about EDI is much different than trying to check boxes.
Yep, absolutely. So right now, there is no evidence that people are paying lip service to this. People are according to the reviewers of NSERC grants, people are very excited to write down what they think about EDI. There's very much a concern about paying lip service. But I think that this rubric is really well designed because it doesn't place an emphasis on numbers. So it's not about making sure that you have gender parity. It's about acknowledging what the problems are and saying what you're doing to fix them, right? And so I think that this is actually, I was very concerned before it came out that it would be about numbers, and it's not. And so I think that was really well done. We actually had a conversation about this earlier about whether it's okay to use these kinds of things to get people on that path to thinking about EDI. And I think that it is, because people actually have to do things. And as soon as you get them started and get them paying attention to the issue and get them thinking about ways, small things that they can do in their labs to support people, I think it's a good thing. I am very much against quotas and that kind of thing. For the same reason, we need to change the culture. And then the women will come, and then the diverse people will come. If they know that this is a place where they can do their best work, they will come. And so that is what we need to be fixing, not the pipeline getting people into. So I hope that answers your question.
Thank you very much for the great colloquium. In order to encourage diversity, one could hope to have courses, say, at the undergraduate level, grad level, maybe even for faculty, for postdocs, about topics such as these. I was wondering how widespread courses like that are within academia, and also if there's any studies about the effectiveness of courses like that.
There are lots of seminars and workshops in graduate studies and undergrad. It really depends on the institution. My institution has a whole graduate professional development program that every single graduate student has to participate in. It doesn't have as much of this as I would like. I would like to see this a little more ubiquitous and also more tailored to the undergraduates. I think it's incredibly important. Yeah.
I have a question about what one possible solution, you know, just for some subset of the problems you've been talking about, it seems to me that, you know, a very effective tool is to move to blind assessment. And so it, in some cases that can work very easily. So, you know, orchestras in recent years,
yes,
many of them have moved to having blind audition.
Yeah.
And there, you know, it really has worked, you know, extremely effectively, and there's much more gender equity.
Mm-hmm.
In other fields, it's harder to do the blinding.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if we're talking about the reviewers of grant proposals or the reviewers of research articles, now, there's a bit of difficulty in the sense that sometimes you can sort of get clues as to who the authors might be based on the content. But nonetheless, I think there is nonetheless value there that we could move. We can make a concerted effort to try to make grant reviews, you know, blind and paper reviews blind. And we're currently not doing that. And I wonder, are we missing out on a big opportunity? So, you know, mm-hmm. given your expertise, would this be very effective if we mm-hmm. sort of made a concerted effort to blind everywhere we could?
Mm-hmm. So the thing about the orchestra audition is that it doesn't matter what came before. You're not evaluating them on how good they are per, you know, the number of awards they've achieved. You're just evaluating them on a skill that they can do right now. And it's virtually impossible to evaluate a professor, a potential professor, a potential postdoc on a skill that they could perform right now in a room. So I think that really limits what we can do when it comes to being gender blind. There are some places, as you mentioned, like papers. There's absolutely no reason for a paper to have gender or ethnicity in the author list. The data should stand on its own, in theory, if it's well reviewed. So that's one place where we could do it. But when it comes to grant applications, if you are evaluating the merit of the researcher, then it both works against for you and against you to know the gender of that person, because some people are going to say, she's a woman, so she hasn't had as many opportunities, so actually she's doing amazing. And other people are going to say, she's a woman, so she's just not as good. So I'm not, especially because science, it's such a small field, especially in Canada, like in NSERC applications, it's pretty easy for at least someone on the panel to know whose research they're reviewing. So I think it's harder to do with grant applications. Definitely something we should be doing for publications.
Yeah. Thank you very much for your talk. I have met three EDI experts in my life so far. I can't help but notice that they are all women.
Ah, yeah.
I wonder if you can address that, how many the white privileged, probably empowered male are actually care about our study.
Okay, so this is a loaded question. So I will say that the vast majority of white men that I talk to care, recognize that this is an issue. Maybe don't recognize the extent of the issue or what the issue looks like, or have any appreciation for what it feels like to be someone who can't be the best that they can be just because they're female or they have a disability or whatever. Then you get down to the areas of, well, who's actually doing the work, who cares enough to do the work. And there are some men, there are some white men who are doing incredibly good work. They are few and far between. And it's an issue. It's an issue that I think should be addressed within everyone's institution. So you have one female faculty member who works very, very hard, I have heard, in these issues. She is working on behalf of your institution. And so as an institution, you should value that in some tangible way. Recommend her for awards, you know, provide her with as an extra student stipend or something like that, because that work is incredibly important and it places an extra burden on her. You can also be allies, so volunteer to take up some of that burden, because like I said, the benefit is to all. As a white male, you are better when you are working with a diverse group of people. It makes you better. It makes you think things. They're more likely to challenge your ideas, and that's a good thing. So I think your institution needs to maybe make a few changes to value that.
Any other questions? No. You tell me.
This might get me into real trouble, but there was, when this was presented at Waterloo a month ago to about 50 some odd science and engineering faculty, they had very serious concerns that quantitative data was frowned upon. And I do find it very strange that NSERC is telling their scientists and engineers to not quantitatively support what they do. There was a person in the audience who thought this was all nonsense as a consequence. So that's one concern I have. And you had people very well meaning. One guy, one man said that look, I took efforts. I made efforts to get women in my group and I have it. And now you're telling me that this doesn't matter. That's one problem. The net effect I have anecdotally is a number of people said, I'll just write what they want to hear. Right? So how would you respond to those concerns?
So you have had to write about how you are supporting HQP for a long time, right? And you've been evaluated on that. And if there were a formula that was a good thing, then they would all start looking the same, right, over time. And that has not happened. There is no evidence that people are writing what they think the reviewers want to hear in their HQP sections. And so there's definitely a concern that, like I said, people will pay lip service and just write whatever it is that needs to be written. There's no evidence right now that that's going to happen. I think it's something to pay attention to evaluate afterwards, to see if maybe that's happening. I have no idea how you evaluate whether or not someone is lying on their CV. Or lying on their application. The other point about numbers is that as a faculty member, you are hiring trainees. And as I said before, we are very comfortable having trainees work for us, but we don't necessarily support them the way that they need to be supported. And so it's not about hiring 50% female or 100% female. That's not the goal. The goal is, how are you being diverse when you hire? And how are you supporting everyone in your lab? Those are the important things, right? Because even if you're hiring 100% women, you're still not necessarily giving them what they need to be successful going forward. And I think one key point is that everyone, NSERC had to make criteria that would fit for everyone. And you can't expect someone starting from 8% faculty or whatever. I mean, I have heard engineers say to me, well, there just aren't any female applicants. So how can I hire diversity if there's no one in the application pool? So you need those people to be able to be excellent and outstanding in order to make them engage with the process. And all it takes is a few small steps to get thinking about this on a regular basis, and I think that is going to snowball into good things. I totally get what people are saying when they're like, we're scientists, we should be backing up this data with numbers. I totally get that. But I understand why it's not been done here, and I think it's a good thing.
Well, I would suggest the scientists and engineers at Waterloo did not understand this.
Yeah.
It was very controversial, and I'm guessing that's not singular. So I don't see why it's either or.
I haven't actually had anyone tell me that they thought it was a terrible idea. So this is actually the first that I've heard that a whole group of people felt that this was a terrible thing. Yeah. I think the general feeling
So don't misunderstand me. They feel the goals are noble.
Yes, yes.
It's the implementation that's the concern.
I'd be curious to know how they think it should be done better in a way that is equitable for everyone, even those starting from different starting points. Yeah.
Any more questions?
Just because you were talking about number, so at PI, this is something we're trying to do. That we can do in the PSI program, so the master program. we have the option, because we have so many applicants, to have a 50-50% class room, yeah, with 50% female students. And so kind of what just, and one of our motivation is that if more female students see more other female, they can figure out that, okay, it's normal. We visit at this level. And I'm, but so what you're saying is that this, yeah, won't be enough, because we need the support behind it to be adequate. And maybe it's not only about number and seeing many female around you that is going to feel that it's okay to do physics and you have your place here, but then concretely, how would you?
I think it's brilliant what you guys are doing, getting more women into the program, because as we saw with the high school provincial exams, physics is the place where maybe at the high school level, we should be targeting high school teachers, get them to stop telling their female students that females aren't good at physics. But that can't be the only solution, right? You can't just say that you're gonna hire 50% postdocs or 50% grad female postdocs or graduate students and then leave it at that, because then they come into this environment that is not supportive and is actually destructive, and they won't be successful. And you want them to be successful. So there needs to be more than that. Yeah. Is that what you were asking?
Yeah, and more if concretely you had, like, you've seen it in other places, which, what can be implemented to add more efficiency?
When it comes to actually hiring?
Yeah, once they are hired.
Once here, they're here?
At least at the level of the master program, it's not an issue of hiring.
Right.
So we have them, but then indeed they're not all staying. Mm-hmm. They are all willing to do it, but they're not all staying at the AI. So then it's true that it seems that we are missing something here. It's not enough.
Yeah.
But concretely, I don't know if you've seen things that work.
Their actual cohort, you need to have conversations with them about EDI. So they need to be on board, like at the student level with this, because students are it's so funny, because the high school students coming up are very savvy with this language about sex and gender and LGBTQ. This is very comfortable for them. It's natural. And yet they still have the same biases. So it's almost a bad thing, because they think they're so savvy that they're not paying attention to their biases, right? And they're also scientists, so they think they're objective and they're not paying attention. So having these, doing everything that you would do in a lab with these students, I think is important, because you get them talking about this and acknowledging that, you know, the men aren't necessarily better than the women are valued. You need to create an environment where the women feel that it's safe to speak up and take risks. You need to tell people that you value that. You need to tell your women that they are doing a good job. Women are much more sensitive to being told that they're doing a good job. They need that because they always underestimate their abilities. And so if you tell them, yeah, this is great, this is what I was expecting, you've exceeded that, they need to hear that. It makes a difference on their subsequent actions, and it makes less of a difference for men on their subsequent actions. So there are lots of things that you can do at that master's level to support the women who are in that program. Yeah.
Thank you.
Perhaps if you can ask a question related to the type program. So as far as in my limited experience, part of the success in hiring is then immediately undermined by the mechanism we use to assign research projects to students. I mean, or with which students look for a supervisor. Because it's left to essentially the student going around the building and trying to knock at doors, and it depends a lot on the enthusiasm or the self-confidence of the student or other cultural biases. Do you have any suggestion on, you know, how do you think we can help the students make contact with faculty members in a way which is fair?
So are you talking about recruiting students into your institution, or?
No, no, so the Psy master students have been hired, they come as a group of 30 students, and then they need to have a research program, which happens sometimes in the second half of the year, sometimes even earlier, just as they come, depending on the preparation.
So So if this is one of your students who
And for this, they need to find an advisor.
Yeah. I think making expectations clear and encouraging people to go out and make those calls is important. Women are less likely to make cold calls, for example. But if you invite that by saying, you know, I am interested, please contact me, then women are more likely to volunteer. And if you are a supervisor of a female, you can tell them that this is something that's important. Women just don't get as much mentoring as others. So they don't know how they're supposed to navigate that system.
Any other questions? Can I take the speaker again?